How many people in the crowd are familiar with VI3 networking features? Okay. And how many people in the crowd are ESX administrators? Okay, how many people are new to networking? Oh, just me? Okay. All right, let's get started. Oh. So, last year I gave a talk on ESX troubleshooting based on proc notes and log files. And at the end of this talk, a lot of people came to me and asked questions about networking. And I just figured out that most of the networking issues that the customers have is primarily because they really don't have a clear understanding of how the virtual switch works. And the majority of the networking problems that VMware gets is all primarily because there's a misconfiguration and primarily on the physical switch. And the other thing is, big companies, big organizations have a separate team for doing network administration, right? And a separate team which does OS administration. And ESX administrators are in this unique position where they have to manage different operating systems. They should have operating systems knowledge. And also they all have to manage the virtual switch because the ESX server ships with the virtual switch. So they are in this unique position that they have to interface with different departments within the organization. And that is true especially for networking issues because more often you have to interact with the network administrators in your organization to get your physical switch configured in the right way. Then there's one of the unique feature of ESX is that you can't treat an ESX host as a physical host which runs a single operating system for a variety of reasons. And one reason here is because we ship a virtual switch. And therefore, you can't configure the ports of your ESX host just like you would configure the ports on a physical machine. So there's a lot of differences. So this talk is basically going to talk about the behavior of the virtual switch through examples and scenarios that you would encounter in your day-to-day operations. And while I was thinking about what scenarios to talk about, there's a whole bunch of scenarios that you can talk about because networking is a very complex piece of subject even on the physical world. And it gets even more complex when you put a virtual switch in an ESX box. So there's a whole lot of things that you could talk about. So, and I was told that I have only 45 minutes for this session. So I just really picked up few essential scenarios, few basic scenarios that you guys would definitely encounter even for a very simplest, from the simplest configuration of your ESX server to the most complex ones. And the other thing with VI3 especially is that a lot of networking features are now exposed to the UI. So now if you can go to the VI client, you can see a whole bunch of options for networking. You can go, it's like a simple checkbox. You can check and uncheck. It's very easy. In 2.x, these features were hidden. Basically, you have to edit the configuration files to do advanced networking. Now all this has been exposed to the VI client, and that also can lead to lots of problems if you don't understand what these features are actually do and what kind of implications that would have on your physical switch configuration. So I'll be trying to cover that as well in this talk. Okay, so these are the basic high-level scenarios. So before diving into the scenarios, I just want to give a primer into the ESX networking internals to some extent. I'm not going to go into very great details. There's a separate talk for that. So this talk is going to give you a brief overview of the ESX networking details. And then I'm going to talk about scenarios which talks about how the virtual switch boundaries are, like what kind of traffic cannot escape through virtual switches and stuff like that. And then VLAN. So VLAN is one of the biggest issue in terms of configurations on the physical switch as well as in the virtual switch. More often you would have networking problems because your VLAN settings are misconfigured. So I'll be touching VLAN. I'll be talking about layer 2 security. load balancing and failover scenarios, and I'll end the talk with some diagnostics. So I really haven't timed this talk, so I may take more than 45 minutes. So are you guys ready to have your lunch a little later? Okay, that's good. All right. Okay, so this is the logical layout of ESX. So this is the most simplest diagram. Basically, this shows the ESX networking into a separate layer. So you have virtual machines, virtual NICs, virtual switch, physical NICs. And if you see, there's a box around it because all these things resides within the ESX server. And then the bar, the black bar, basically segregates your ESX server or the virtual world from the physical world, where you have the physical switch and the physical machine. It's quite simple. So what's the problem with it? The problem is you have multiple layers, and which means you can interconnect these layers in different ways, and it leads to very interesting possibilities. So in this talk, very specifically, we're going to talk about the virtual switch layer and the physical switch layer. I'm not going to delve into the virtual mix or physical NICs, which is obviously out of scope of VMworld, but I'm not going to talk about virtual NICs or virtual machine in great detail. Okay, so this is the ESX 3.x networking architecture diagram, and I just want to put a little disclaimer. Engineers are pretty bad in putting diagrams, so if it looks pretty ugly, then please excuse me, because I took a lot of time to put this diagram up, and I don't think I got the entire architecture captured in this. So I'll try to explain as much as possible based on this diagram. Okay, the first point is all the physical NICs are now managed by the Veeam kernel. Now, this was not true in ESX 2.5, where you would dedicate the device, certain physical NICs, to the service console, and the service console would use those NICs as it would use on a physical machine. But in 3.x, all physical NICs are managed by Veeam kernel. This is a big change, and it has some interesting implications as well. And one more thing is, all these physical NICs which are managed by ESX servers typically run in promiscuous mode. The reason for that is ESX servers supports multiple virtual machines, and each virtual machine has its own MAC address, and therefore I should be able to see the packets for all MAC addresses, which means the physical NICs needs to run in promiscuous mode. And this also has very interesting implications. For instance, if I connect my ES, all this physical NICs to a hub instead of a switch, then hub is going to repeat the same packets on every port, and which means all the physical NICs is going to see the same packets, and those packets can be sent to the guest OS, so you might see duplicate packets in the guest OS. Right? So things, small things like this have very interesting implications, but apparently, I believe all you guys must be using ESX server connected to a switch and not to a hub, so we shouldn't have to worry about that. The next point is the Veeam kernel uses Linux drivers. So we have a VMK Linux compatibility layer, which basically allows you to, Veeam kernel is our own, VMware's own kernel, but we can take the Linux drivers and we can run it with the VMK Linux compatibility layer. And typically when we take the Linux drivers, we make modifications to the driver to some extent. Basically, most of them tends to be performance tuning ones or bug fixes. Mostly it tends to be bug fixes. So we used modified drivers. And third one, and it's a very important point, is all traffic which comes from the top has to go through some virtual switch. And this was not true in ESX 2.5, where the console OS traffic never need to go through a virtual switch. The console OS can directly communicate to the physical network. But here, every traffic has to go through a virtual switch. And this also has a very interesting implication, because now any properties that you configure on the virtual switch affects all the traffic that goes to the ESX host. Okay, so, you know, virtual switch has got plenty of functionalities. So like Ethernet switching, VLAN tagging, layer 2 security, load balancing and failover. I'm going to talk about all these things in the forthcoming slides. And also, if you see there's a small dot, dot, dot at the end of that, what this means is it's very easy for us to add new functionalities to the virtual switch. So tomorrow I can, right now the virtual switch operates purely on layer 2. And tomorrow I can plug in a firewall in the virtual switch, or I can add some layer 3 functionality in the virtual switch. So it's right, but as of now, as it stands now, these are the basic set of functionalities that the virtual switch provides, and you can expect more functionalities in the future. And then, on top of the virtual switch, you have port groups. So I'll be talking about port groups in detail later in this presentation. Now, port groups are the entry points to the virtual switch. So you can't access any of the virtual switch functionalities without using a port group. I'll go into the details of port group later, so I'll skip over to the next one. And then, I'm going to use a term called clients throughout this slide. And what I mean by clients is that each port group has a client attached to it. A client is the one which is going to send the traffic. And the clients could be like a VMXNet driver, a VLANs driver, and it could be a TCP/IP client, or it could be a COS client. I'll talk about these details later. And all these clients inherits the properties of the port group. So the clients themselves do not have any properties. But depending upon which port group they're attached to, they have different properties. And which is, again, a different design. This is a completely different from in ESX2.x. Okay. And then, VMCurl lab uses its own TCP/IP stack. If you look at the diagram here, I mentioned about various TCP/IP stack. You have a virtual machine, and virtual machine has its own TCP/IP stack. And you have a service console, which is, you know, is based on Linux, and it also has its own TCP/IP stack. And then VMKernel also has its own TCP/IP stack, and it's based on BSD. And this TCP/IP stack, the VMKernel TCP/IP stack has some interesting functionalities. So one of them is like we have a functionality called Cost Shadow, which I'm not going to talk in great detail in this presentation. In fact, I had some slides for this, but I removed it because it's too complex to explain, and I really don't know if that's worth explaining because it's quite transparent for the normal usage. So let's take a look at the top level diagram now. So Service Console has a NIC, and right now this is a virtual NIC. So the Service Console really does not have access to the physical NIC. It has a virtual NIC, and we call it as vSwift. And it uses the COS client, which runs in the VM kernel. And if you see this shared section here for the VMXNet and the COS client, basically this tells us that these drivers share some data structures with the VM kernel. And why do we do that is for performance reasons. You might know the VMXNet gives you better performance compared to VLAN. It's primarily because of the shared data structures between the VM and the VM kernel. Another thing you should notice, Service Console is placed in the same position as in the VM. So for all purpose, you could treat the Service Console as a Red Hat Linux VM. That includes networking also. So depending upon how the Service Console is plugged, to which port group it plugs, its behavior can change, just like a VM's behavior might change depending upon which port group it's plugged into. Then you also see the reason why we use the TCP stack for the VM kernel is for all the TCP traffic which is used by the VM kernel exclusively, like for things like vMotion, things for IP storage, all these things uses the BSD TCP stack in the VM kernel. So that's why I mentioned vMotion and IP storage. And there's also this one item which is called as MKS, which stands for mouse, keyboard, and screen. You might have seen this in the log files if you have taken a look at the log files, you might see instance of MKS, which stands for a mouse, keyboard, and screen. And what this means is all your keyboard activity, all your mouse activity, and all the screen information that you get, they all ask to basically the remote console session. They all go through the VM kernel TCP stack, which is here, using a cost shadow. And so let's take a look at the kind of traffic you could see on a ESX toast. The first traffic is the traffic to the console OS, and this is for the VI client managing your ESX toast. The traffic goes to the console OS. And second is the virtual machine traffic. And virtual machine traffic is the traffic which is actually sent by the virtual machine to the physical machines or other virtual machines on the network. And then the third point, this is the remote console traffic. This is a separate category of traffic. And the fourth one is the IP storage. And the fifth one, which I couldn't show in this diagram, is the vMotion traffic. So the reason why I listed out all these kinds of traffic is, it is essential for you to know, like, if you have a remote console session issue, if you have trouble connecting to your virtual machines using a remote console, then you should know where to look for this problem. And we should know what kind of traffic would be affected if you change which port group policies. For instance, if you change the port group policy of service console, you're going to only affect the service console clients. Okay, so let's take a look at the virtual switch. So as I mentioned earlier, virtual switch operates completely in layer 2. So we don't have any layer 3 functionality. This is a very important point to remember, because most physical switch, even though switches are layer 2 devices, have layer 3 functionalities. So our virtual switch is pure layer 2 device. And a virtual switch, And a virtual switch can have zero or more uplinks. And what we mean by uplinks is the physical links. Why we call it an uplink is because physical link is the one which connects your virtual switch to the external world, to the physical switch. So we treat that as an uplink. And one of the important properties of a virtual switch is that the virtual switch cannot share the uplinks or the physical links with the other virtual switches. So if you want to divide your network traffic, you want to isolate your network traffic, you should create two virtual switches and dedicate two some set of NICs to one virtual switch and the other set of NICs to the other virtual switch. You cannot share this physical NICs. And then to use a virtual switch, you should have at least one port group defined. So let's see what a port groups are. So in this diagram, there is a virtual switch. This entire box, the green box, is the virtual switch. And there are three port groups colored with, I've used different colors for the different port groups. And these port groups are not broadcast domains. They are not separate broadcast domains. This is again a common point which gets confused. Primarily because in ESX25, we had the concept of port groups and use the port groups only for creating VLANs. But in 3.x, port groups has got more functionalities than VLAN. VLAN happens to be one of the properties of port groups. So port groups are not broadcast domains. What this means is I can have three port groups, but if I plug, let's say if I plug a sniffer here, I could still see the traffic going through this port group. They would be isolated only if you create separate VLANs for each of these port groups. So that's one important point. And then I've showed a virtual machine here. And if a virtual machine gets different properties depending upon which port group it's connected to. So if it's connected to this port group, it follows all the policies defined in this port group. Now this is again an important point, because let's say in the case of a vMotion, you can move virtual machines between physical hosts. And when you move virtual machines, you're also basically moving a virtual machine from one virtual switch to a different virtual switch, and one port group to a different port group. And if the port group policies are not consistent, then you might get different behaviors for the same virtual machine after you vMotion it. So that's a very important point. Then port group policies override virtual switch policies, which is, again, you must have seen it in the previous diagram. The other important difference between a port groups and a virtual switch is that port groups can use a subset of a NICs which is available to this virtual switch. For instance, this virtual switch has about three NICs, but I could define a port group which only uses these two physical NICs or these two physical NICs. So this is a very powerful feature. So let's see if I got a small animation here. Okay, so it's connected to a different switch. Now you see it's using two NICs instead of three NICs. And port groups can share NICs with the other port groups on the same virtual switch, which is again different from a virtual switch behavior. So the implication here is the same set of physical NICs can be used for different policy settings, for different VLANs. So what this means is, if, for instance, this one is using VLAN 5, and this one is using VLAN 10, then I would see VLAN 5 traffic on this NIC, and this NIC, and VLAN 10 traffic on only these two NICs. Okay, so. Alright. So let's see how the virtual switch is viewed by an from an external device. So for all purposes, you could always treat a virtual switch like a dumb switch. Why it is dumb is because we don't speak too many protocols. The reason why we don't speak too many protocols is not because we don't, it's because primarily because we don't have to implement them. For instance, the virtual switch does not speak a spanning tree protocol. And you might wonder why we don't speak spanning tree protocol, because this is such an important feature on physical switches. The reason why we don't speak spanning tree protocol is because we don't introduce loops. The only way to introduce loops is if we allow two virtual switches to be interconnected or cascaded, and we don't allow it. Our virtual switches are isolated, and virtual switches cannot share physical links. So the loops are not possible, so we really don't have to worry about spanning tree. And a virtual switch does not talk protocols like DDP, VTP, VLAN trunking protocol, dynamic trunking protocol, ISO, all the standard features which you would find in commercial physical switches. We don't speak link aggregation control protocol. This might be surprising for many of you because we support link aggregation. ESX supports link aggregation, but we do not support the link aggregation control protocol. The reason is the virtual switch doesn't have to negotiate link aggregation with the physical switch. And so if you want to do link aggregation, you have to configure the physical switch in manual mode, the physical switch ports in manual mode. I'll talk about this later when we get into link aggregation. The only difference is we are planning to support CDP, Cisco Discovery Protocol, in the future version of ESX. We are doing this only for management purpose. The reason is, right now, the network administrators really don't understand that you have a virtual switch in a ESX box. So if we implement CDP, the network administrators can discover the virtual switches and they could understand the topology much better. So from the internal viewpoint, how a virtual switch is different from a physical switch. A virtual switch does not learn MAC address from the traffic flow. If you know layer 2 switching, if you learned about layer 2 switching, you know that physical switches associates the MAC address with the switch ports based on the traffic flow, so that it doesn't have to broadcast the same set of traffic on all the physical switch ports. But virtual switch doesn't have to do that. The reason is, the moment a virtual machine gets powered on, and the moment a virtual NIC gets registered, the virtual NIC notifies the MAC address to the virtual switch, and therefore we know which virtual switch port as this particular MAC address. So we don't have to snoop all the traffic which is going to the virtual switch to actually learn the MAC address. So every other MAC address, every other unicast MAC address, now it belongs to the uplink port, which is your physical link. Then link negotiation. This is all in the virtual world, so why do you want to do link negotiation? So we don't do any link negotiation. Which also means the virtual NICs, which is the virtual NIC you've seen in the guest OS, do not reflect the speed and duplex state of the uplink. So the uplink is completely different. Uplink is from after the virtual switch, and the virtual machines are before the virtual switch. And they do not have any correspondence to the speed and duplex state of your physical NICs. So your physical NICs could be in half duplex mode, but if you look at the VM might report full duplex mode or 100 Mbps. They have completely no relationship. This is true even on a physical world, right? You have one physical box, you have a switch, and if you have an uplink to the switch, the uplink is misconfigured, your physical machine is not going to see it. So that's the same behavior here. The only time when the guest reports link down status is when the virtual Ethernet device is disconnected from the UI. Otherwise, the link is always on. The virtual NIC link is always on. The other scenario where you might see the link as being down is when the NIC driver inside the guest server crashes. Then Windows might report that the link has gone down. Okay, let's talk about virtual switch boundaries. Virtual switches are isolated, so I explained why they are isolated, because we don't want to introduce loops. So let's take in this example, there's a virtual machine A on one virtual switch and virtual machine B on another virtual switch, and this virtual switch communicates to the physical switch only through a physical NIC. So you see this physical NIC here, and this is a physical switch. By the way, all the diagrams which in my slides, the bottom portion always refers to the physical world, and the top portion is the virtual world. So this is a physical switch. Now, if virtual machine A wants to communicate to virtual machine B, even though they reside on the same ESX host, they cannot talk to them. We can't bypass the traffic and send them directly to the this machine. So any traffic from A to B has to go through the physical switch. So this is a very important point to remember. If you want to bypass the communication between A and B, if you don't want them to appear on the physical switch, then you should use a single virtual switch. Okay, so this is an example where there's a virtual machine which has two NICs, one connected to one virtual switch, the other connected to the other virtual switch. And in this case, if this virtual machine acts like a bridge, then it can introduce loops. So if you have, let's say for instance, you run a Linux guest has this bridging functionality that you can turn on. If you turn on bridging functionality, then you could introduce loops. And when you introduce loops, you are in charge of making sure that a spanning tree is activated in your virtual machine itself. But we don't do it. We don't arbitrarily introduce loops. And the other thing to note here is, if you want to use both a virtual switch, which in turn means both a physical NICs, then you should put these virtual NICs on separate subnet. If you don't put them on a separate subnet, then the guest OS is going to send the traffic on the first route. And all the traffic will always go through one virtual switch. That's why I've used different subnet here, 1.x and 2.x. This might vary depending upon your guest OS behavior. For instance, Windows uses, if you have multiple routes, Windows might round robin them. So the policies can change. But in general, you should put them in separate subnets if you want to use two different physical NICs. The reason why I explain this is, this has a very important implications on your vMotion and your IP storage. So let me explain that in the next slide. So VM kernel TCP stack, I mentioned earlier, it's used for vMotion, also for IP storage, your iSCSI, NAS, or NFS. So VM kernel TCP stack, VM is like almost like a virtual machine. You could treat it like a virtual machine. There's only one TCP stack, right? If I use the same subnet for IP storage as well as for vMotion, then my traffic might go, my vMotion traffic can go through this virtual switch and not through the other virtual switch. And this has a very important implication. I mentioned that all traffic has to go through a virtual switch. All virtual switch will have port groups. Each port group will have its own policy. And you might want a different policy for vMotion and different policy for IP storage. But if you don't use separate subnets, and if you end up using the same subnets, then the vMotion traffic might end up going in the wrong NIC and with the wrong set of policies. So this has a very, very important implication, which is very easy to overlook when you design your network. Okay. The other question is, often customers ask, why do I need to trunk physical switchboards? So this diagram basically explains why trunking is necessary. So basically this uplink between the virtual switch and the physical switch is basically, it's like cascading two switches. The only thing is one is a physical switch and the other thing is a virtual switch. And when you cascade switches, let's say even on a physical environment you cascade two switches, the ports which are used for cascading the switches are called as trunk ports. The reason why we call it trunk ports is the trunk ports can carry VLAN tag frames. Because the VLAN information has to be carried from one physical switch to the other physical switch. And therefore the tagging happens on the trunk ports. So in this example, VMA is in VLAN 5, VMB is in VLAN 1. The frames, when it enters the guest OS, does not have the VLAN tags. So they are untagged frames. The same goes to the physical machine over here. When the frame enters the VLAN, this port, it is untagged. But as soon as it enters a physical switch adds the tags. And this tag information needs to be carried over so that this virtual switch has the same information on which ports the frame needs to be delivered. So the inter-switch communication, the virtual switch and physical switch communication carries the tag frames, and which means your physical switch port should be configured as a trunk port. So if you don't configure as a trunk port, then you would have problems with your VLAN connectivity. Okay, native VLAN. I just want to take a small survey. How many people have been bitten by native VLAN? Oh, that's quite a lot. So I know that native VLAN is most one of the most confusing things in terms of configuration. And we often get lots of issues from the customers. It's primarily because they don't understand how native VLAN works, and they probably have an incorrect configuration on the physical switch. So let me explain what the basic idea of native VLAN. So on a physical switch, native VLAN is a VLAN where there is no tagging done. So I can call a VLAN number, a VLAN 95, and whenever I use VLAN 95, there is no tagging done on the physical switch. So untagged frames, the physical switch treated as VLAN 5. But virtual switch, on the other hand, does not have any notion of what native VLAN is. So in this case, communication between A and B fails. The reason is the virtual switch forwards only tagged frames to B because you configured that as a VLAN 1. So when the packet goes here, it's untagged, it gets tagged here, VLAN 1 goes as untagged because this physical switch does not tag native VLANs, and untagged frames are not delivered because virtual switch knows this VM is only on VLAN 1. So instead of sending the frame to this port, it might send the frame to this port, which is untagged. So the VMB can never talk. But on the other hand, VMB can talk to the physical machine A. It may or may not work depending upon how the physical switch implements it. The physical switch may accept or may not accept tagged frames on the native VLAN. So this might give you weird, so when you're troubleshooting problems, you might get weird behavior where your ping might work in one direction and may not work on the other direction. And it could be probably because of a native VLAN. So the workaround for this issue is you could put VMB on a port grid with no VLAN tagging. That is, you should move VMB to this port, and then the frames would be delivered. But the better way of doing it, or the recommended way of doing it, is enforce tagging on this particular switch port. So most physical switches now, even though they support native VLAN, you could exclude certain ports from native VLAN, in which cases the physical switch would enforce tagging on those ports. So you could do this. So this is the most common recommendation that we give to the customers. Okay, so this one is slightly a complex example. And if someone didn't get this example, you can come and talk to me in person and I could explain this to you in great detail. So in this example, on a physical switch, you have two different VLANs, VLAN 5 and VLAN 10, and I interconnect these VLANs using a loopback cable. Now, this is same as cascading two switches. When I cascade two switches, what I do is I put both the switches on the same broadcast domain. And when I interconnect two VLANs, basically I'm doing the same. VLAN is a switch. It's a virtual switch in the physical world, right? And when you interconnect them, you basically put them in the same broadcast domain. So ideally, on a complete physical world, A and B can communicate with each other. The reason is a packet coming from A goes with VLAN 95, carries a tag frames here, it comes with VLAN 5, the tagging gets removed, enters VLAN 10, it gets tagged again with VLAN 10, goes here, and then this VM receives it, which is perfectly fine. It should work. But on ESX 2.x, you would have an issue that the response packets from B, they won't reach this virtual machine A. It's because when the response packets come, we know the MAC address of the destination machine, and we know they are both belong to the same virtual switch, and therefore, instead of forwarding it to this port, we directly try to send the packet to this VLAN. And then the packet gets dropped because there is a VLAN mismatch. So we corrected this behavior in ESX 3.x. So if you see this behavior in 2.x, you could upgrade it to 3.x to fix a problem. Now, one thing somebody might ask you is why somebody would want to interconnect a VLAN 5 and VLAN 10, because that basically defeats the purpose of VLAN. Because you put them in the same broadcast domain. The reason why you want different VLAN is put them having them on different broadcast domain. When you interconnect them, you put them in the same broadcast domain. So there is really no reason to do this. But I recently, while preparing this talk, I found out that certain Cisco operations might, I think Cisco load balancing software or something, might require that you use two VLANs and you interconnect them in the same VLAN. So I can give you details on it if you can come and talk to me in person. Okay, so VGT. VGT stands for virtual guest tagging. The VLAN tagging is done inside the guest OS and not on the virtual switch. And what this allows you to do is you can have multiple VLANs for the same virtual machines. So in this case, virtual machine B has configured VLAN 5, 7, and 10. And the way you configure this is by specifying this port as with the VLAN ID 4095. And this is a special VLAN ID. The allowed range for VLAN IDs are 1 to 4094. And if you use VLAN ID 4095, then we make this port as a VGT port and allow the guest to use any VLAN tags it wants. Now, this has a very interesting implications here. So, since VGT allows the guest to use any VLAN tags, they can arbitrarily send any VLAN tags. So if your guest gets compromised, then the guest can send packets on any VLAN it wants. But if the guest gets compromised, then that's a problem that you have to fix. It's nothing to do with the virtual switch. So the virtual switch on this side does not filter the VLAN. But on the physical switch side, you could filter the VLAN. You could filter the VLAN. For instance, on the physical switch port, on the trunk port, you could say what VLAN tags are allowed on this particular trunk port. So I could designate this. This trunk port accepts packets only with VLAN tag ID 7 and 10. Anything else gets dropped. But even if you do that, you could still cannot prevent this virtual machine B from talking to virtual machine A because they both belong to the same virtual switch and they are both part of the same VLAN. So even though you might prevent the communication between B and P, on the different VLAN, you cannot prevent the communication between A and B. Okay, so since we talk about security, I want to delve into the security features that VI3 provides. So ESX security features provides functionalities which is not at all possible on a physical machine environment. So this is one of the advantages of virtualizing things. So the first option here is promiscuous mode option. So if you say promiscuous mode is deny, then the virtual NIC can get into promiscuous mode, but it won't receive any frames other than what is intended for itself. So if I run a sniffer, and if I say promiscuous mode is deny, the sniffer would see the packets, but only the packets which matches his MAC address. Any of the packets which is on the wire, you won't see them on the virtual switch. There's one other option, which is forged transmits. And what this prevents is, it prevents the guest from spoofing MAC address. So the guest changes his MAC address and sends a spoof frame. I can write an application at the user level which chooses arbitrary MAC address frame and injects those packets into the network. And those packets will be dropped because we know what is the actual MAC address of the virtual NIC. And we compare it, and if there is a mismatch, we drop those packets. So this is possible here. The other one is, you want to prevent MAC address changes itself. This is different from the previous option. Here, we don't allow the guest to change his MAC address at all. So whatever MAC address you specify in the virtual hardware configuration file, that is the MAC address. The guest cannot go and modify the MAC address. For instance, in Linux, it's very easy to change a MAC address using ifconfig. You can do ifconfig ether hardware and you can change the MAC address. And same with Windows. You can change the MAC address if you go to the device properties. And we could prevent this using this option. Basically, we allow the guest to change the MAC address, but it won't receive any frames if the MAC address got changed. So why do we have this option deny MAC address changes? So I mentioned the guest can change his MAC address to send spoof frames. And also, a guest can change a MAC address to listen to other traffic when the promiscuous mode is denied. If you go back, this option only disallows a traffic coming from a different MAC address, but allows traffic which is the MAC address of the virtual NIC. So a clever hacker can he can go and change the MAC address of the virtual NIC and then start sniffing. If I don't see any traffic, then I'll change my MAC address and start sniffing. So in the hope that I'll find some kind of a traffic. So that is prevented. So that is why you also have to deny MAC address changes. So for your best security, it's always recommended to deny all the three options so that you can be completely sure that security problems can happen on your machine. The other thing that I want to mention is all these are layer 2 security options. I think somebody is leaning on the wall. Okay. Now this layer 2 security has some interesting interactions. So you should be careful when you make your security to be too tight. For instance, if you say deny forced transmits, there are lots of applications which actually forges MAC address for genuine reasons. So it's not necessarily someone has hacked into your system, but there are genuine applications which actually changes his MAC address. A good example is the Microsoft Network Load Balancing Server. And if you use this service, Microsoft NLB service, basically, when it operates in unicast mode, it doesn't use its own MAC address, it uses a forged MAC address to send for all the outgoing traffic. And the reason why they do it is to prevent the physical switches from learning the actual MAC address, so that the incoming traffic for that particular IP address gets forwarded into every other port. So, again, if you want more details on this, I would be happy to explain this in person. But the bottom line, the key takeaway from this slide is that NLB operating in unicast mode will have problems if you have deny forced transmits. Another example, but a very subtle example here is duplicate IP address detection. This again is a scenario where Microsoft uses forged MAC address. So one of the things you must have noticed, the difference between Windows and Linux is that when you have a duplicate IP address on a Windows machine, the machine which actually has the IP address, the machine which first came up, is the machine which has machine which is defending its IP address. The machine which came back later is a machine which is trying to take away the same IP address. In Windows environment, the machine which actually came up first retains its own MAC address and does not allow the other version, other machine which came back to take the same MAC address. And the mechanism that it uses to detect duplicate IP address involves some ARP requests and ARP responses, and it uses some MAC address forging so that it always ensures that the machine which came up first is the one which retains the MAC address. So again, I can go into these details later, so I'll skip this slide now. Okay, so there's one other feature which also existed in 2.5, but we didn't have a GUI for it, but now we have it. So it's very important to know what it does. So this feature is called a switched notification. And what switched notification does is that whenever a client MAC address, now a client could be a virtual machine or an IP storage, or it could be a vMotion interface, any of it, whenever a MAC address is a new MAC address appears, we notify to the physical switch explaining where the MAC address actually resides. So the way we do it is we send out a raw frame. When we send out the raw frame, the physical switch knows that this MAC address resides on that particular switch port. And we also send this raw frame whenever we move this client MAC address to a different physical link. There are lots of situations where you might move a client MAC address on a different physical link. For instance, you vMotion the VM, or you change the order of active NICs in your setup, or you change your load balancing policy where the client traffic can be sent through a different NIC. All those things affects the location of the client MAC address or the VM's MAC address. So we send a notification to the switch saying, oh, this MAC address is not on this switch port, it's on a different switch port, so update your CAM table entries so that you forward the traffic on a different switch port. And the reason why we chose use RAP is because it's a layer 2 broadcast, and layer 2 broadcast reaches every switch which is on the same broadcast domain. And it doesn't disrupt the ARP cache, which is different from the CAM table maintained by for the physical switch. And to do this, we don't need to know about L3 information, which is layer 3 information is not required to send them the RAP packet. This is completely layer 2. So that's again the point that I explained before, that virtual switch operates completely in layer 2. We don't need to know anything about what layer 3 protocol you use. Okay, so this is an example of a switch notification. So here you have an ESX server, you have a VM, and you vMotion the VM. And when you actually vMotion the VM, you're basically moving this VM from one virtual switch to the other virtual switch, which is on a completely different ESX source. And also, you are moving this VM from one switch port on the physical machine to a different switch port on the physical switch. And since the location of the VM has changed, we need to notify the switch. And that we do that using a raft frame. Now, the other implication of vMotion is that the virtual switches on source and destination should have identical security policy. And this is checked by VC. So this is, for instance, you have a very critical VM where you enforced all the layer 2 security policies, and you don't want the VM to compromise on security when you vMotion them to a different host. So the VC actually checks if the security policies are matching. If it doesn't match, we don't allow you to vMotion it. But that's the only item it checks. But you could have different port group settings. You can have different VLAN settings. So after the vMotion, you could vMotion the VM from one VLAN to a different VLAN. VC doesn't check for all those conditions. So if you have network connectivity problems after you moved after you vMotioned your VM, then it's a better idea to go and check the port group policies on the source and destination host. So it's only virtual switch name and the security policy that VC actually checks for. But you can have the same virtual switch name and you can have a different VLAN setting or a different load balancing policy. We don't check for those things. Okay, so let's talk about load balancing. So we have different load balancing mode. And the one we're going to talk about is the source MAC or the originating port ID mode. Now in this mode, the outbound NIC is chosen based on the source MAC or the originating port ID. The reason why we do this is when we choose it based on the MAC address, and we, let's say for VMA, we chose this particular NIC because this is a unique MAC address, and VMA also has a different virtual NIC, and we chose this particular switch port and this particular physical NIC. Now, since the MAC address is not going to change for the VM, you could expect that traffic from VMA will always consistently come in on only these two physical NICs. And this is a very important property for the physical switch, because the physical switch does not want to see this MAC address on all the physical switch ports. So every time the VMA traffic is coming, you could be sure that the traffic is always will be seen only on this particular port. So that is the advantage of OutMAC. Similarly, the replies which is coming from the virtual switch will always come to the same path, because the physical switch would have learned the MAC address association with this particular switch port. So all the inbound traffic will go only through this particular virtual NIC. So this load balancing is useful only if you have more virtual NICs than physical NICs. And the VM cannot use more than one physical NIC unless it has more virtual NICs, basically because of the protocol we use. And this is the IP hash mode, where we chose the outbound NIC based on the L3 address pair, which is the IP address in most of the cases. But if you're using a different protocol, if you're using IPX, then we use whatever field which is there instead of IP there. We use the same information. Yeah, the scalability is depend on the number of PCIP sessions, because the NIC that we choose here depends upon the source and destination pair. So if your VM is communicating to only one destination host, you're not going to see any performance benefits. A good example is if you do a FTP transfer, a bulk FTP transfer to a destination host, all the traffic will come through only one NIC, because the source and destination IP address are the same. So you're not going to get any benefits from having additional NICs or using NIC teaming in that case. Now, the other important implication of out IP is, let's say you're communicating with different IP address. Now, traffic could come through different physical NICs. And what this means is the same MAC address can be seen on multiple physical switch ports, which could be a problem for some physical switches, because they don't like multiple association for the same MAC address. So physical switch always wants to associate with one MAC address to one physical switch port. So this could be problematic. So this could actually disrupt the MAC address learning capability on physical switches. And also, it also makes the inbound traffic unpredictable, because at one point, the physical switch thinks this MAC address resides on this port, so it might forward the traffic here. Next point, it it might think the MAC address on this port, so it might forward the traffic here. So the traffic could be completely ad hoc. It could come on different physical NICs, the inbound traffic. Okay. So NIC jamming also introduces another complication, which we call it as packet reflections. So in this case, you have multiple physical NICs, and let's say a broadcast packet comes from this particular port. Now this broadcast packet has to be sent, will also be sent to the other ports. The switches always send the broadcast packets on all the switch ports. So the packet might bounce back and come back to the same VM. So whatever packet the virtual machine A sends, well, broadcast packet sends, will bounce back and come back to the VM again. So this is going to be a problem because your virtual machine has to process more packets. If it sends 100 packets and if you have 3 NICs, it's going to receive 200 packets back. And it needs to process those packets. It's going to consume a lot of CPU cycles. So in ESX3, we added a feature where the packet reflections are filtered. So any packet which, any broadcast packets which are coming back through the wrong link, we actually filter it. The way we identify the wrong link is based on what load balancing method you use. If you use OutMac, I know OutMac always sends the traffic through this particular physical NIC, and therefore, I know any of the packet received on these frames are incorrect. So we drop all the frames which are received on the wrong link. But in Out-IP mode, since we can't predict the inbound traffic, we allow the frames on any NICs. So this packet reflection feature is enabled only when you use OutMac or a source port ID. So the guest OS is ignore duplicate packets. You don't have a problem. The only problem is would be a performance issue if you use an application which relies on frequent broadcast and multicast packets. A good example would be Microsoft Network Load Balancing. So to avoid this problem, you could do something called as link aggregation. So in link aggregation, what you say is, you teach the physical switch ports, saying that these individual switch ports, they all belong to one single link, one single aggregated link. And when you teach the physical switch that these are aggregated links, switch maintains only one entry, one CAM table entry for all the aggregated ports. So the switch does not have this learning, MAC address learning issue when you do that. And so this works well for Out-IP. But that is the only benefit of link aggregation. Traditionally, link aggregation was done in the past for improving your throughput. So this was done in the days when you had 10 megabit links and 100 megabit links. You want to improve your pipe bandwidth, then you aggregate 2 or 3 100 megabits and you get 300 megabit link. But today, it is not that relevant because we are in the day of gigabit speeds and 10 gigabit links are coming up pretty soon. So link aggregation does not offer you those benefits. The only benefit you would see is because these ports, the switches now know that all these ports are going back to the same host. So that is the only advantage of link aggregation. So in link aggregation mode, is incompatible with source MAC and source port ID mode in ESX3.x. So this is a very important feature, and this is something very specific to ESX3.x. The reason here is because of the previous slide that I explained about packet reflections. Packet reflections are on by default for OutMac, so which means you don't expect traffic on these two NICs. But when you link aggregate it, then you would expect traffic on these NICs. So we would drop the packets, and therefore you would have issues with source MAC and source port ID. Okay, so this is an example where you have a multi-switch configuration, where you also have individual NICs connected to separate switches. The only requirement is all the switches need to be in the same broadcast domains, which means they have to be trunked and ISO'd. Now, the problem is, with the kind of a setup is, you have to deal with multiple physical switches. So the trunk port here, you have to make sure that they have identical configuration on all the physical switch ports. If you have different configurations, then you would have problems. For instance, if you allowed VLANs 5 and 7 here and you allowed only VLAN 7, then some traffic you'll have problems. So you have to be careful and make sure that all these trunk ports here have identical configuration. The other problem is, in Out-IP mode, is actually not recommended for this setup, because a MAC address can appear on any of this physical NIC. So it can appear here, it can appear here, it can appear here. But at the same time, the MAC address also can appear on this. The same virtual machine MAC address can appear here. So if you have a physical machine connected here, and the traffic comes from here, it goes to the trunk port, and then it comes to the physical machine here. But next time the traffic can come from this port. So this physical switch will be confused whether the MAC address resides on this particular port or on this trunk port. So we don't recommend IP hash mode for a multi-switch configuration. The even more complex configuration is you can combine link aggregation and multi-switch. But again, the scenario is exactly the same as before, and it does not offer big benefits for you. The reason why I put this sliders up is because we get a lot of questions from customers saying whether a setup like this would be useful. But in my opinion, it does not bring you a big value addition to you. It only complicates your network setup. Another thing is you cannot, ports from different physical switches cannot be aggregated into a single link. For instance, I can't combine all the four ports into one particular link. Sorry, can you repeat the question?
On a Cisco side, do I need to configure the channel group command to channelize, to consolidate these two links into one single logical?
Yeah, you have to configure link aggregation on the physical switch ports to combine these two links into a single link, and that uses the 802.380 link aggregation protocol. Yeah. Okay, so failover scenarios. So here we're talking about what happens when the Ethernet link fails. How do we fail back? So these options again are very confusing in the UI. So I just want to go through this option very quickly. So the failover detection can be done in two different levels. One, we can just look for the link status and see whether we need to fail over to the other link. We also have a feature where we can detect switch failures. If the switch itself failed, then we would move the traffic to a different link. Then we have a failback policy. The failback policy says what happens when the failed link came back. What do we do with the traffic? Whether we move to the original link or do we keep continuing on the same link? So there's an option called rolling failover. And when you set it in no, and what this means is the failback is on. And then, if you look at here, you have the order of the NICs you could specify. And we have three different items here. Active adapters. These are the adapters which are active for that particular port group. And you have standby adapters. The standby adapters are adapters which will be used only if the active adapters are failed. And then you have unused adapters which are completely excluded from this particular port group settings. Now, there's one interesting implication. If you change the order of the active adapters, it switches the traffic flow through the NICs. For instance, in outpack mode, I might have decided that this particular VM traffic should go through adapter number 1. But if I change the order, then the traffic will go through the other NIC, whatever NIC which is on the position number 0. So it's not bound to the actual physical NIC, it's bound to the order in the active adapter. So this would be useful for troubleshooting. If you want to send the traffic through a different physical NIC, you can just quickly come and change the active adapter order, and then you'll see the traffic will be routed through a different physical NIC. So there's one interesting implication of failback. So failback mode is on by default, and what this means is if you have a flaky link, which means the link status goes up and down, then you would see the MAC address appearing on different ports, because at one time it will be on one switch port, another time it will be on a completely different switch port. So, and also, physical switch, when the link comes up, they don't accept traffic immediately. It takes some time before the traffic it's accepted by the physical switch. It basically depends on what kind of protocols are enabled on that particular switch port. So, for instance, if you disable spanning tree protocol on that particular switch port, the thing that we recommend is using port fast mode on the switch, then you could stay up to 30 seconds before the link comes up. And same goes to protocols like PAGP can say 15 seconds. So the recommendation is disable all the protocols that you, which are virtual switch doesn't really require, and then you, so that you get instantaneous failover when the switch port comes alive after a link failure. So these are some slides on diagnostics. So basically this shows you how to find the link state. This is a command esxconfig-nxhel. You really don't have to use all these commands on the service console because we export all this information in the UI now. So this is the UI equivalent. And one of the interesting features we have added in ES6.3.0 is that we also snoop traffic on that particular VM NIC, and we give you an idea of what subnet it belongs to. So this value might be incorrect because basically depends on what kind of traffic that we see on the network. So if your physical network is screwed up and your configuration is incorrect, then we might report incorrect information here. And then this is the command for getting virtual switch settings, and this is a UI equivalent. And then I also mentioned about VM Connect TCP IP stats, and that's exported in a proc node under this. And you could see the VM kernel interfaces and what port group numbers they use. And we can also see the routing information for the VM kernel. So this is very important to know which interfaces we choose for what kind of traffic. So in one of the slides I mentioned that you should isolate IP storage and vMotion on separate subnet. If you haven't done it, then you would see the routing table would have collapsed here. And then we also have a new command called vmkping, which is introduced in ESX3.x. And this command uses the VM kernel TCP stack for pinging. So the reason is the service console uses its own TCP stack. If I use all the networking commands, it's all for the service console interfaces. So if you use ping, then it's going to use service console TCP stack. But if you want to know if the connectivity is correct for all the VM kernel traffic, then I have to use vmkping. So the last resort for any troubleshooting is to collect networking network traces. So that there are a lot of interesting characteristics when you collect network traces. The most fundamental problem collecting network traces in ESX is that you have lots of virtual machines and lots of network traffic going through the virtual switch simultaneously. So when you collect network traffic, you would be overloaded with information. You would quickly fill up your hard disk space if you collect network traffic for a short period of time. So it's very, very important, like, where you actually collect the network traffic. That way you could actually isolate the traffic that you are really interested in. So the way to collect network traffic is run TCP dump inside the guest or in the service console, and then the traffic visibility depends on the policy settings. So if you're interested in seeing all the traffic without any VLAN tags, then create a port group or attach to a port group that does not have VLAN ID, and then run the sniffer from the VM. Then you would see all the without the VLAN tags. If you want to see traffic with the VLAN tags, and you want to see traffic from the entire virtual switch, then use the VLAN ID 4095. And as explained earlier, if you disable promiscuous mode, you're not going to see all the traffic. If you're going to enable promiscuous mode, you're going to see all the visible traffic. So that's all I have. So I'll be happy to take questions offline if anyone is interested. And I'll be available in the Developers Cafe tomorrow if you have questions there as well.